The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. I've taken our crew, camera crew, out on the road, continuing to do a lot of filming, not in our studio in New York, way out on the West Coast. Today, we're going to have a continuation of our conversations with remarkable minds. My guest will be Professor Sandra Steingraber. We're going to talk about protecting our children in an age of environmental crisis and the health risks of fracking, all about gas fracking. Now, why is that important? Because I'll bet many people who thought the next good move for them would be to the country, or those who live in the country or the suburbs thought we're okay here. Well, think again. All over the United States, but mainly in Pennsylvania, New York, and areas down through the Carolinas, over in Kentucky, Tennessee, and West Virginia, they have been getting the gas out of the ground. And how they're doing that is what is called hydrofracking. We're going to talk about the dangers of that and why you better start checking your water supply. So that's one of the issues we're going to deal with. Also today, I'm going to share some insights, an interesting article I read by Tisha Johnson from Life Extension on why the Japanese have lived such long lives. And there are some things that we didn't know before, the specifics that you'll find out today for the first time. The latest on health and healing, and also time permitting, I'll talk about prepare for the next conflict, water wars. This will be in our environmental section. So we have a lot to share, and time permitting, we'll also take your calls. Let's begin. I'm always looking for different foods that have healing power. Once I hear about a food in my travels, and especially one that's been used for a long period of time, and that they have some evidence that it really makes a difference, I then see if I can find anything within the scientific literature. Now, that doesn't mean because it's not in the scientific literature that it's not legitimate. Remember, reality always precedes scientific validation. And then when I do see this food, and I do see that there's something in the literature that supports it, then I believe we really should bring it into our diet. There's one food called cassava, C-A-S-S-A-V-A. It almost holds a mythological status as a superfood. It's been used for a long time. You might also know it as yucca, or tapioca, or manioc. These are all the ways that they label it. It's all the same. It's a crop plant, and it's like sugarcane. It has a very high yield of food energy per cultivated amount of the actual food. It's very nutrient dense. In fact, it is the third most imperative source of calories in the tropics after rice and maize. And if you add in rubber and rice, cassava is one of the top essential cash crops, and it's a main source of income for some of the poorest farmers in the world. It's a sustainable crop. And why it's so important is because at least 500 million to a billion people consume it and have for a long time. And anytime you go to the Caribbean, I don't care where in the Caribbean, you can always find dishes made from it. But it also is known as a medicinal plant. The cassava yucca was recognized from the indigenous tribes, the Caribbean, the Tenos, and it has a very good benefit to the immune system. It's boiled generally. They boil it in large pots, and then they squeeze the juice out of it, or they eat it along with fish and other vegetables. And if you use olive oil on it, and garlic in it, and put some cayenne in it, particular, it's really terrific. It's one of the most nutrient-dense. So for people who don't have a lot of money but want to eat something that gives them a lot of nutrition and good quality complex carbohydrates, it will do it. Now, I'm recommending for people with arthritis, diabetes, colon cancer, irritable bowel syndrome, cardiovascular disease, and even nervous system disorders. In fact, it was the native population that first used cassava, and they didn't know that it had an extract called saponin in soap. It's been used today to produce shampoos and soaps. And so that's our nutrient of the day, something you may not have used, but find it. It doesn't take long to make. And there are many different ways you make it. You boil it, you peel off the skin, and you can chop it up into pieces, put it into a blender, maybe put some soy milk in, or rice milk, or coconut oil with it, maybe a tablespoon or two, and it comes out the consistency of mashed potatoes. And then, as you would with any mashed potatoes, you could saute some shiitake and white cap mushrooms, put some salt and pepper, because with that pepper, you're getting pepperine, and that's a very, very good nutrient for the body, very good spice. I'm just saying, let's broaden our perspective, and it's not expensive. I'm always asked about hormones because so many people in this audience are going through perimenopause, menopause, or andropause, or postmenopause, and are concerned about what changes have occurred in their bodies. I was even read something on the plane about Arnold Schwarzenegger, who well, he said when he looks in the mirror now, he says, what the blank happened to his body? Well, when you smoke cigars and you don't take your supplements, and all you do is exercise, then you're going to break down the muscle tissue you have. Your hormones, especially your free testosterone, are going to diminish. Your human growth hormone is going to go down. And your skin's going to sag. And your jaws will drop. And your muscle will turn to fat. And then you won't look like you once did. Or you can do the right thing. I just wished I could work with a Clint Eastwood or someone for a year. I'd like to see any person who was famous and respected take a real serious look at reversing the aging process. When I get back into New York from this trip, because this is the final trip for filming on what I'm doing now to wrap up our current important documentaries, I'm going to bring all these documentaries out in the late summer, early fall. We'll have five of them coming out. I've never produced five really hard-hitting, full-impact documentaries on social issues at one time. But I'm doing it now. And because I feel the time's right. And each one's for a different movement. But then I'm going to do, at that point, I'm going to do an anti-aging one-year program. The trouble is most people who are celebrities don't like doing anything that requires a commitment of time and energy about themselves. Now, they might do it for their work, their career, but I can't tell you how difficult it is to get celebrities to stick with a protocol. They're so used to having everything their way. They're so committed to their own ego, and everyone else around them is an enabler. You don't have the people saying, hold on a second, what are you drinking the alcohol for? You know, why not drink the juice? They do what they want to do because you'll earn their wrath or you'll be thrown out of their circle if you challenge them. And yet that's exactly what they need, not just for their health, but also for a lot of other reasons. And even those who are certainly socially conscious, like Sean Penn, he smokes, he drinks, he's got a terrible diet, and he looks it. So the fact that someone may be motivated and progressive in one area of their life doesn't mean that they carry it forward in all areas, especially their health. And when they're young, they don't think they have to do anything. They've got their looks, got their energy, and they're accepted. So they can eat, drink, whatever they want, smoke, take drugs. It doesn't matter. There'll always be someone there to provide it for them. There'll always be someone there to make excuses when their behavior, like Nicolas Cage, goes over that line, and then they have to apologize. We shouldn't have to be apologizing because we should think before we do these things. And that gets me back to this thing. If we only had one single celebrity in any area, it could be sports in any area, who's willing to take 1 year out of their life and devote it 100% to their health. If they then could have this all documented and show that, look what they look like, look at their blood chemistry, look at their immune system, now a year later, look. Because only two people cause us to really do anything in life. That's what I've come to at this point in my life. And having been a part of so many movements and so many social causes, nothing ever happens, or it happens and it dies, unless you have a policymaker and opinion leader help lead that cause and sustain it. When you had Nader's Raiders, 500 of the Ivy League's lawyers and others came down and supported him. And then when they saw, gee whiz, this is real work, it takes commitment, they all left. Only a handful were left behind. And they went on to found groups like Michael Jacobson, Sidney Wolf. But without a Ralph Nader, what happens? Well, how about nothing? Because before him, nothing happened. And after him, nothing happened. He did more by himself from 1965 to 1976 than any human being in American history as far as protecting our environment, protecting our rights. But yet, somehow, we couldn't figure out that maybe this man who has such insight and is uncompromising in his issues of truth would make a good leader. Boy, did we get that wrong. Sure he would have. But anyhow, if someone who we respect and who is a policymaker does something, then that shifts the paradigm. And in fact, it challenges the paradigm. It's like when Dean Ornish, for the first time, showed that you could reverse arterial and arterial sclerosis by diet, exercise, meditation. And he published it in peer-reviewed journals. He presented his information. Finally, all the other doctors who had been doing bits and pieces of it or doing it quietly came forward and said, wow, now we can do it because he's respected. He's one of the inner people. And then the pushback came. I remember debating with him on PBS, National PBS, where there were all these different experts. And they did not like his program. They were into the drugs have to do it, and you're risking people's lives. No, he's not risking anyone's life. They're risking lives. They were the ones that didn't have science on their side. They had the mythology of a belief on their side. We believe these statin drugs. We believe coronary bypass. We believe these stents and balloon angioplasty will cure the cause. No, it didn't. Balloon angioplasty and coronary bypass operations have never cured a single person. And in fact, it only gives them a little bit of time to go after the cause, or it causes the disease process all over again. So even when a policymaker does make a difference, and he did, you also then have to have opinion leaders who support that in order to keep the paradigm from throwing him out the door. Now, let me just give you one example. I believe that Luc Montagnier, who won the Nobel Prize last year for discovering the HIV virus, will be marginalized, denigrated, attacked, ridiculed, mocked, slandered, libeled by those within the AIDS community that profit from it and its dysfunction and corruption, and those within orthodox science who are so terrified of the idea that this man who created the entire paradigm of AIDS. Remember, without Luc Montagnier, Robert Gallo wouldn't have been able to use Montagnier's sample in his lab at the National Cancer Institute, which, by the way, was all determined by major hearings and therefore shared in the royalties on anything coming from it. But now he says, and you've heard him on this show say, that if you have good clean water and good clean diet, antioxidants, you can prevent HIV infection. That means that the sex part is not a part of it, because you could have all the antioxidants in the world and you could get a sexually transmitted disease from someone who's infected. The antioxidants are not going to protect you at all. You could drink all the clean water in the world. You're going to get syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia, herpes, papilloma. So the fact that he's saying that, and then he said the second part, which was the coup de grace to the AIDS, HIV myth, he said, if you have AIDS and are HIV infected, and if you take your antioxidants and your clean water and clean diet, you can eliminate it. Again, that has, think of what that did to the $800 billion AIDS industry. And all the scientists and universities, all the gay activists and the AIDS activists, all those people that have made a reputation in ACT UP and other organizations by promoting one approach only, one truth and nothing else. No one is tolerated when you challenge them, no matter what your credentials, background, Curry Mullis, Nobel Prize winner, whose work was used in AIDS when he discovered the polymerase chain reaction and won the Nobel Prize in 1993 in chemistry for it, when he finally said, I asked Gala, where's your papers on this? I want to see the evidence. And I didn't see any evidence. I then began to realize maybe this wasn't the case, this single virus caused this. And Curry Mullis, one of the brightest scientists in America, then started to do more homework, and the more he looked into it, not believing what was said, but proving it for himself, he found that it was all based upon lies. Now that Montagnier, just this year, made these statements, he believes in oxidative stress. Gee whiz, that's what we've been talking about all along. Watch them destroy him. As they did Linus Pauling, another Nobel Prize winner. So even if you are at the top of your game, unless you immediately have opinion leaders come to your aid and, in effect, build a wall between the policymaker who's taken the chance to open a paradigm and the opinion leaders who are the public advocates. These are not the scientists per se, but these are people who are major advocates who are respected by the public and can talk with the media and talk with individuals and say, here's the truth of it now. Let's change. Let's get on the right page now. History will be on our side. But if you don't have those opinion leaders, and Linus Pauling did not, Curry Mullis did not, and Luc Montagnier does not at this point, then watch the institutions and their black op groups and the paid people on their behalf. Watch the attacks, the ad hominem attacks, the scurrilous attacks. Now, I say this simply because anytime we look at the truth, look for the truth in health, environment, the truth is always present. But it's like that white hot coal. Who's going to pick it up with the fear of being burned versus the person that picks up and says, well, it was just the illusion it was white hot, and then does something with it. So we have the truth about how to get healthy. We have the truth about how to slow down the aging process. We have the truth about how to reverse cancer, prevent heart disease, reverse diabetes, reverse the conditions that so many people suffer from and die from. We have all the knowledge. We don't need new knowledge. We only need a new way of knowing. But there is where the media fails us, left and right. Left actually, in many cases, are the worst purveyors of truth. They hold up the doctrines and they have the attitude to attack anyone who tells the truth. That said, now let me go back to old Arnold Schwarzenegger. Like him or not like him, his politics or his movies, anything else, Arnold is in that unique position of both being a policymaker as governor, but more importantly, opinion leader. People will like his politics very little at this point, but they will still appreciate his personality, hence an opinion leader. If he were to reverse his aging process, I believe that a lot of other people would start to pay attention. If any other bodybuilder did it, no one cares. You have to be in the public eye. You have to be someone that people respect. Then you get people's attentions. Then people start to at least examine the issue. And that's what's important. So this message is for Arnold Schwarzenegger, or those who know him who will share this. I'm going to make it real easy for everyone who wants to do something really simple, not the full-out program. That takes time and commitment to study and know what you're doing. Just one little simple example. It's called pregnenolone, P-R-E-G-N-E-N-O-L-O-N-E, pregnenolone, pregnenolone. It's a hormone. We produce it in our body, and it's produced by the glands, the liver, the skin, the retina, and in the brain itself. It's made up of cholesterol, and in the cells of both the adrenal gland and the central nervous systems, studies have identified it as the most important role player in keeping your brain young. It's only been around about 65 years, and it is a tremendously important anti-inflammatory, and that's why I've always recommended for people with Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, multiple sclerosis, but I've even recommended pregnenolone for people with arthritis. Research into cortisol, which is a stress hormone, and as many as our flight and fight hormone, which lasts about a minute, minute and a half once you start to really pump it, then you get this fatigue because you've used it. It started to get all the attention because they were doing work on cortisol about the same time. So in effect, pregnenolone was just pushed to the side. And it couldn't be patented by the big pharma. So they made synthetic versions of it, such as estrogen and testosterone. That they could patent. So what happened was that despite having recognized very important benefits to our overall health, it didn't become popular. And but if you want to help your memory, and as your body ages, and that means after the age of 30, you can find that it makes a difference. And the older you are, the more of a difference it makes. Here's how it works. Pregnenolone works by keeping the brain clear and sharp by blocking GABA, which is a neurotransmitter that works by inhibiting the firing of neurons in the brain. It reduces general brain activity and prevents the brain from overheating. Higher levels of GABA, gamma aminobutyric acid, associated with aging, can make the brain sluggish. Well, pregnenolone also stimulates the formation of new brain cells. And though we were told you don't get new brain cells, that's old science. The new science, yes, we do, and we can prove it. And we can rejuvenate an older brain. So this whole idea that somehow mom and dad, grandpa, grandma, losing their memory, nothing we can do, that's not true. That's myth. That's dinosaur thinking. We have found that there was a 55% increase in cell growth in the brain after pregnenolone had been used. And that continued after just one treatment. And studies undertaken on old memory-impaired rats proved that recall problems were reversed after pregnenolone. But that's not all it does. It also helps fight arthritis. It helps you elevate your mood. It helps heal spinal cord injuries and even phobias. And because pregnenolone has an inability to be always compatible with all the other chemicals in the brain if it's taken in high amounts, then you don't want to use it just casually. For example, people who have a history of seizures wouldn't want to be using it. It's generally available in prescription form, and I would only recommend people using it under the care of a physician. But there, if Arnold and some of the others out there decide to help their brain de-age, that's one of the ways they could do it. One other superfood, I mentioned cassava earlier, but it's coconut. More and more and more we're finding out how wonderful this food is. And mother's milk, of course, is considered the most perfect food on the planet for human consumption due to its perfect nutrient balance and its ability to build the immune system. The closest match in nature to mother's milk is found within the coconut. It's loaded with fatty acids that give it a unique taste, but also that unique taste gives it an abundance of health benefits. Now, for those of you who don't understand the chemistry of it, it's simple. And coconut oil has an abundant amount of small to medium chain saturated fats. They're called medium chain triglycerides. And most common vegetable or seed oils consist of long chain fatty acids, also known as long chain triglycerides. And the long strain triglycerides put a greater strain upon the pancreas and the liver and the GI tract. So the body has to package these long chain triglycerides with carrier proteins that require special enzymes to effectively metabolize. These medium and small chain triglycerides are smaller and as a result permeate cell membranes easily without the need for carrier proteins or no enzymes. It's not required. They go directly to your liver where they're immediately converted into usable energy. So they're not stored as fat. In fact, the medium chain triglycerides don't depend upon bile or pancreatic enzymes to be effectively metabolized. This makes coconut oil fully digestible. And it's great for people, let's say, who've had their gallbladders taken out. It's also the single most stable of all the oils that we use due to its high composition of saturated fats. And this stability is important because it reduces free radicals in our bodies. So it's a phenomenal antioxidant. It doesn't oxidize easily. It helps balance other hormones. It stabilizes your blood sugar. It boosts the cellular healing process. And it can also be very beneficial for your thyroid gland, especially if you have an underactive thyroid. It helps increase your metabolism. That means you're going to burn fat easier and lose weight. And it's great to help clean the digestive tract. So coconut oil should be a part of everyone's major detoxification program. Now here's what's special also. Both mother's milk and coconut oil are rich in lauric acid, which is converted in the body to monolaurin. And I can't tell you how many people with AIDS-defining illnesses I've counseled, thousands. And I make sure that they had them monolaurin. M-O-N-O-L-A-U-R-I-N. Why? Because it is one of the most powerful antibiotic, antiviral, antifungal substances known, and it's non-toxic. So a lot of people came to me with thrush in the lungs, and I remember one guy came in one morning, and when he began to talk, I could see it looked like he had stuffed little cotton balls, sanitized cotton balls, into his mouth. So I asked him, is that a massive overgrowth of the thrush? He said, yes. In fact, before we talk, we had one of the physicians there come in and clean out the mouth. He took, I'm going to guess, about a quarter of a cup of yeast overgrowth out of his mouth. The trouble was the yeast was in his lungs, and that's how you die. Anyhow, I put him on a protocol, which included a lot of bitter melon juice and monolaurin, and within 1 week that was cleared up. It's also great for anyone who has viral outbreaks of anything. Remember, it's these are all good for us, and yet powerful at destroying harmful microbes by damaging the cell membrane of those competing organisms. That makes coconut oil, in my opinion, terrific for cold season and flu season. Add that with your other nutrients. And also, I massage it into my hair at night and massage the scalp. It's great for your skin. So that's the latest on health and nutrition. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Have you with us, everyone? I'm Gary Noll. And we're going to be joined here in the studio by Joe. And also, if she's in studio or in the office, Elizabeth, they're both reading the mail and taking turns sharing questions from the audience. And then we're going to go to, Elizabeth's not here, we'll go to Joe, and then we'll go to our guest. And then once we get into our conversation with our guest, I'll also then give out our number, and I'll give you that number, not right now, but a little later on, our 888 number, so you can call in. Let's say hello to Joe, who's in our studio in New York City. Hi, Joe.
Hey, Gary. How you doing today?
Doing great.
Got a couple of questions from a couple of listeners. First one's from Miguel. Miguel's been listening to you for 5 years now and is becoming concerned because 3 years ago, you predicted that people should not move to Central America because of the drug cartels. He tried to tell his brother and father this, but they didn't listen. Now, one lives in Costa Rica and one lives in Panama, and things are getting bad there. So could you please explain again why they should sell their properties in Central America?
Okay, I can't suggest people sell their property anywhere. All I can do is give my overview of what I see, because I like to study all the different countries of the world, every different country in the world, and where it's at, what is impacting it, its political leadership, its environmental concerns, its economy, its stability, and then it's not that difficult then to give some educated guess of where the country's likely to go. Now, once there was a major push by the United States and Colombia to close down the Colombian connection between Colombia and South Florida, where that cocaine was coming. And keep in mind, the United States is the cause of this, because there are only three countries in South America that produce 95% of all the cocaine used in the world. And we are the largest user of the cocaine in the world. We use more than all the other countries combined. And it's expensive. With Colombia, Peru, and Bolivia are the major producers of cocaine. But we consume it. The wholesale price of a kilo of cocaine, I believe, is somewhere around $12,000 or $13,000, which makes it very profitable for those who are in the business. So now the Coast Guard interceded in the Caribbean, mainly in Jamaica. And they stopped it from a plane would go from South America, refuel along the way, then land in Jamaica up in the Blue Mountains, then refuel there, and then go on into some place in Florida. That was all shut down. Now what they've done is they've started using, and have been for some time, using Central America. And Mexico is now using Central America. In fact, did you know that there are more kidnappings and more violent deaths in Central America than there are in Mexico or Colombia?
Wasn't aware of that, Gary.
Yet the three most dangerous countries in the Western Hemisphere are Guatemala, El Salvador, and Nicaragua, and Honduras. I actually had four. For people who don't know where Central America is, you have Mexico. Then at the bottom of Mexico, you have Belize. And then right beside Belize, you have Guatemala. Pretty good-sized country. Then right below Guatemala, you have El Salvador. Then you have a humongous country, Honduras. Below Honduras, you have Nicaragua. And then below that, you have what was considered the best places for people to go and retire, to vacation, to go to ecological tourism in Costa Rica. You have Costa Rica and Panama. And then that connects to the north end of South America, and the northern country connecting is Colombia. So that's how the drugs in Colombia, they just drive it right up through. It's all land-based. They can drive in there. Now, historically, they're very, after all the revolutions of the 1970s and 80s, one of the things their constitution mandated was cutting back on the military. So in some countries, they cut out the military, like in Costa Rica, 100%, and have a small 10,000-man police force. But in other countries, they cut back so severely, but they did not expand their police force. Then they ran out of cash, ran real short on cash. Their storms, hurricanes, earthquakes started to devastate these countries, flooding. And then in came the gangs. And as the gangs were the first thing to come, and that's what you look for, Where you have gangs, you are going to have social instability. You will never have enough police to keep up with the gangs. And the gangs started in, went from Mexico into Guatemala, and then into Honduras, then in Nicaragua and El Salvador, which is utterly corrupt. And then two things happen. The police are bought off, the government officials are bought off, and the rich have the security apparatus to protect them. Did you know, Joe, that in every one of these countries, that they have five times more private security forces than they have police guarding people?
Really?
You can't live in Mexico or Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, or Panama now unless you have armed guards. Every home has, looks like a prison fortress. By the way, this was happening 20 years ago in Puerto Rico. Now you see it in Costa Rica. So now that the gangs are there, the gangs are making money, but they're making money not by getting paid. Here's something unique that the drug cartel did, and I'll bet probably no one in this audience has heard this, but they don't pay anyone in cash anymore for smuggling drugs. They pay them in drugs. So imagine what it is when you're paid in drugs to sell those drugs, and now you create your own little gangs. The gangs go out and actually sell the drugs on the street. Now, it used to be that all these countries in Central America only were couriers. Not now. Major manufacturing of drugs, growing of drugs, the drug of whatever source it's used, and then processing is now in these countries. So there's massive battles going on. So you can't be there. It's one of the most dangerous places in the world, in all the world, even worse than Russia. And I didn't think anything got worse than the corruption in Russia. All the government officials are bought off. The police, the majority are paid because the little amount of money they make. And suddenly a drug guy says, look, in Mexico they call it lead or silver. You got a choice. You don't have a third choice. You take the silver, we give you money. That means we own you. You tell us everything we need to know. If you refuse, then we're going to give you lead. We're going to shoot you in the head and cut your head off and put it on a school step someplace. That's what they do. So now think of all those people who just wanted to hear all the good about Panama and the school teachers from America who were going to retire there or have a second home there because they were only sold on the beauty. Yes, it is. And Costa Rica, absolutely beautiful. And the rainforest there, terrific. And the development, business friendly, low taxes. In fact, the actual tax rate in most of those countries is under 10% because the rich don't pay taxes and the businesses don't pay taxes. And the middle class are the ones who are squeezed to pay taxes. So without the taxes, they don't have the cash to rebuild the infrastructures and to create anything representing a stable economy. So now I wouldn't live anywhere in Central or South America. It is too unsafe. I will go on the record to say that Costa Rica and Panama will become the next jungle ghetto for two reasons. You got people who made the mistake of living there, and you got gangs and drug lords willing to go in there and say, you kidnap that guy, you can make $2 million. That person, $3 million. So there's no protection you can get that's going to protect you from a gang that wants to nail you. So Costa Rica and Panama, no, write them off. They're gone. That's my thought. Thanks for the question. Now we're going to go over and say hello to my guest. I'm very concerned about the whole subject of how we're extracting our oil and gas and coal and the foolishness, I believe, of biofuels. But the gas people are some of the smartest. They keep telling us that it's clean energy. It's not. They tell us that it won't upset the environment. It does. But they've done something that is purely Machiavellian. They've managed to buy the political process that's protected them and allowed them to have enormous free rein on which chemicals they use in hydrofracking, and being able not just to take the gas out of one specific well on someone's property, but not be responsible for what happens when that chemical mess, that soup of toxin, goes into underground wells and aquifers where people turn on their faucets and fire can come out, or the chemicals are too toxic to consume. Then you would assume we have an FDA, an EPA, a USDA. We have agencies that are surely there to protect us and would not allow any of this to happen. That's where our guest comes in. Professor Sandra Steingraber is an internationally recognized biologist, environmentalist, poet, activist in the tradition of Rachel Carson. She's professor of Ithaca College, upstate New York, and was named the Utney Reader as one of the most 25 visionaries changing our world last year. And as a cancer survivor, having protracted bladder cancer at the age of 20, she's researched thoroughly cancer clusters associated with industrial pollution and has written extensively on the drop in the age of puberty among girls, agricultural famines, and cancer in the environment. And she's written several important books that have resulted in her being heralded as the next Rachel Carson by the Sierra Club. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Right now, we are witnessing so many different epidemics of disease and illness and conditions in children, from diabetes, autism, obesity, childhood cancers, a vast array of allergic conditions. We're seeing boys and girls' hormonal systems going into severe imbalance from early puberty in girls to sterility in boys. And I feel it's obvious to any sane person it is the toxic stew from our unregulated or underregulated industrial culture that is the culprit. And the listeners to this program are well aware of this. So I'd like to first hear you, given our politico-corporate culture today and the fact that there is no serious effort being made to put brakes on the sources of chemical toxicity. And I'd like to hear from you where we will be in another decade, not 50 years, 10 years or so, if everything continues as it is now.
Right. So this, the question you asked is, it was actually the question I asked myself a couple of years ago that led to the publication of my new book that's being launched this week called Raising Elijah, Protecting Our Children in an Age of Environmental Crisis. The book is named after my now 9-year-old son, Elijah, who is afflicted with one of the many disorders that you mentioned, namely asthma. So my research in toxicology and environmental health, I have a very personal stake now in understanding the way that air pollution can alter the development of children's respiratory tracts, among other things. And so in Raising Elijah, I try to convince readers that the environmental crisis is the moral crisis now of our time. And we're not talking about future generations. We're talking about the kids that sit across the table from us now, the kids who sometimes share their bed with us, our own children. They are the children who, within the next 10 years, will be the major victims of two branches of the environmental crisis, one the chemical pollutants and the other climate change. And, of course, both of these branches of the environmental crisis share a root cause, which is our economy's ruinous dependency on fossil fuels, of which hydrofracking, I think, is the new one to watch, because that of coal, oil, and natural gas now, all of the capital investment and all of the energy policy making is chasing after gas. And so there are several chapters and a lengthy discussion in Raising Elijah, which represents my best attempt as a biologist to kind of summarize the risks from this new extreme form of energy extraction.
Thank you. Now go into the details. Explain to us what are the risks and how pervasive are these. People like to think, oh, I don't see any gas wells around here. I'm in a safe area. So take us through how that well, 200 miles away from where you live, could impact you depending upon the hydration factors. Take us through that part of it, and then take us through the second part. What are the likely consequences to your health or your children's health? Because they're the environmental canaries in the coal mine. They're far more susceptible to these environmental antigens than are humans, or adults, I should say. Those
okay.
two parts are important.
Sure. So I had to learn a lot of geology to write Raising Elijah, so I'll start with that as the entry point here. So in 32 states out of 50 of the United States, the bedrock is made of shale, and shale represents the bottom of an ancient ocean. So in that part of the United States that used to be covered by a shallow sea, there were sediments down there, and in many, many years ago, namely 400 million, the Earth's atmosphere did not yet have enough oxygen in it to decompose all the bodies of the creatures that lived in these seas. So when they died, they became bubbles of methane and then got trapped inside these layers of sediment. So this layer of shale is kind of a great graveyard, if you will. And over time, it became covered over with other sediments and under enormous pressure turned into shale. Also trapped within this layer of shale, which exists a mile or two below our feet, are heavy metals and elements that represent things that eroded away from the mountains that used to surround this ocean. And so here on the Marcellus Shale, where I live in upstate New York, the shale contains radioactive elements. And also, that's why we have trouble with radon in our basements. And also things like cadmium and mercury and arsenic and lead and so forth. All right, so that's what we're talking about. And the new idea to become energy independent, this is T. Boone Pickens' big plan for America, which is rapidly becoming the kind of blueprint for a bill that's now getting increasing number of sponsors, the Nat Gas Act. The plan is to fracture, to shatter this bedrock using high-pressure solution of fresh water mixed with chemicals that will reduce friction and allow the gas bubbles to be released from the rubble and travel back up to the surface. In addition, there are actually living organisms that far underground. They live on the hydrocarbons down there. And so it's also necessary in this mix of chemicals that goes under the ground to put some biocides in there, powerful poisons, so you kill organisms that might otherwise slime up the pipe so that the gas can get out. And one of the pioneers of this new technology was Halliburton, and one of the innovations that it introduced was the ability to fracture by drilling sideways. So horizontal hydrofracking means you go down into the shale and then turn sideways, use some explosives to begin to shatter it, and then under very high pressure, as much as 10,000 pounds per square inch, like shattering a windshield with a baseball bat, you inject into it this kind of poisonous mixture of water. And because you can run these horizontal drills a mile or two under the ground, it's possible to go underneath other people's property a mile or two down there without needing to get their permission, for example. And so different states regulate these things in different ways, but I think one of the main points is that the EPA, our federal agency, has no real jurisdiction over this because the gas industry has been very clever in gaining exemptions from all of our major federal statutes, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and so forth. So that's what we're talking about. And there may be indeed enough natural gas, so-called methane, under the ground to power things for maybe 15 years, maybe 100 years. But there's lots of, trillions of dollars to be made here. Now, as for consequences, first of all, there are things that we know for sure will happen. They're not risks, they're certainties. And among these is that our rural roads will be filled with fleets of tanker trucks hauling hazmat. And so every well requires about 1,000 tanker trucks because there's so much water has to go down the hole to do this. And so many thousands of gallons of chemicals, essentially about the equivalent of a backyard swimming pool volumes worth of chemicals has to be mixed with about between 2 and 8 million gallons of water for every well. And because these gas bubbles are kind of spread out down there like a fizz of petrified champagne bubbles, you have to frack a lot to get gas out. So it's a kind of shock and awe operation. To make this profitable, you have to kind of blanket the landscape with the infrastructure required, the wellheads, the pipelines, the access roads, and so forth. So what we're talking about here is the industrialization of our rural areas, and the consequent habitat fragmentation, soil erosion, loss of pollinators, problems with flooding that come with soil compaction, and of course loss of our farmland. These things we know will happen. We also know that when you have a gas patch, you degrade the air quality with chemicals that are known to be linked with cancer, known to shorten pregnancy in women, leading to higher risk of preterm birth, known to cause asthma among children, and so forth. And these smog-related chemicals don't stay within the gas patch. They can actually travel, as you suggest, up to 200 miles away. So it degrades air quality for children living, many miles away. So even though right now in New York, for example, we have a temporary moratorium on fracking, 90 miles to the south of us in Pennsylvania, it's an absolute gas rush down there. And so I know for a fact that my asthmatic son's air quality where I live now has already been affected because we're downwind of that, what's going on in the northern tier of Pennsylvania. And so this is a human rights issue that we all need to consider, and it's also an economic issue. I mean, the question becomes, do we want to lay waste to our land in order to get natural gas out of the ground? Because that's a capital investment. Or do we want to take that money and leap right over fossil fuels and invest it in non-fossil fuel renewable sources of energy? You can't really do both. So we stand at a great crossroads, and I hope my book, Raising Elijah, which is my attempt to kind of understand the toxicology of fracking, but also because I live in the crosshairs of an area where, 40% of the land here in my county is already leased to the gas drillers, even though they're not here yet. It's a story about me raising a family in a place that is targeted.
Last question for you. I was speaking earlier in the program, and I don't think you were on the line yet, about who causes change and who pushes change forward, either within the existing structure, paradigm, or against it. And it has to be a policymaker and opinion leaders working together. Right now, the policymaker is Barack Obama. The opinion leaders around him, and as well as policymakers in other paradigms, all are on the same page, meaning oil, gas, coal, and nuclear are all working together. They all have their major supporters and opinion leaders. And then the people in the legislatures, also a lot of them are on board, both Democrat and Republican. We don't have major policymakers who are out there saying stop gas fracking, stop this nonsense of clean coal, stop the insanity of nuclear, and let's go towards renewables that are non-polluting, and we can make this happen in a relatively short period of time. So now that you've laid out the bad part of the story, what confidence do you have that the very people that we are trying to motivate, our politicians, who are allowing all this to happen, they're deregulating, they're making it easy, just like right now, there's new oil permits to dig at 5,000 to 10,000 feet in the Gulf. It's being and these are flooding now into the process. What's to prevent all of America, where there might be gas, from having these wells put up? And then we just see, as you said, this whole boom. What's to prevent that from happening?
Well, I think there is a widespread human rights movement underfoot. The film Gasland hinted at that. I was just recently lobbying in Albany with Josh Fox, that director. He's busy creating a follow-up film about the rising up of people who are objecting to the desecration of our water and air in the name of using an inherently dangerous extreme method for extracting another fossil fuel out of the earth. And And in my own book, Raising Elijah, named after, you know, my son Elijah, but my son Elijah himself is named after the abolitionist Elijah Lovejoy. And so in the book, I try to write about the pediatric environmental health movement that parents are leading that is like the abolitionist movement of the early 1900s. You know, Elijah Lovejoy was assassinated in my home state of Illinois, not far from where I grew up, in the 1830s, at a time when the changes in agriculture made slaves more valuable. And so people who had their wealth in slaves got wealthier, you know, just in the way that when the real estate values rise, people who have lots of property have wealth. And Elijah Lovejoy in that moment said, it doesn't matter how dependent our economy is on slave labor, it's a homicidal abomination that needs to stop. And for that, he was pumped full of 5 bullets. But he won the day. He inspired, his best friend was head of Illinois College and went on to influence Abraham Lincoln. He inspired John Brown. He inspired Harriet Beecher Stowe, who wrote Uncle
Sandra,
Tom's Cabin.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. Hopefully your book, along with Gasland, the film will inspire others to realize if we wait for those who've already been purchased to give back the money, the legislators, then we're going to have the wrong approach. Let's hope that we, the people, can figure out how to go to the streets and demand that this be stopped. Thank you very much.
Well, it's the new abolition movement of our time. That's right.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. I appreciate all your good work. Professor Sandra Steingraber, my guest. I'm Gary Noll. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.
Modesty reveals to me self-appraisal often makes us sad. And if I add your funny face appeals to me, please don't think I've suddenly gone mad. You have all the qualities of Peter Pan.
The Gary Noll Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Taubenfeld.
Your sunny, funny face, for your acuity with more.